the station, putting me on a train. I've got no expectations to pass by here again. Once I was rich, now I am so poor. Never in my sweet, sweet life have I felt like this before. Heart is like a diamond. You throw your pearls at swine, and as what you leave in me, you packed, baby, you packed. I'm a peace of mind. Love is like the water that splashes on a stone. Our love is like our music. It's here and then it's gone. Take me to the airport, strap me in the plane. I got no expectations but to pass through here again. I won't pass by here again.
Hello, and thanks for listening to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. If you're just tuning into this program, we're listening to Beatrix Hoffman talk about why the United States has been one of the few developed countries not to adopt universal health care, and examines why the issue is so divisive.
In the U.S. health system, until 1986, it was legal for hospitals to turn away patients simply because they could not pay. And that is still true in the case of non-emergency conditions. We have a huge number of studies showing that economic barriers lead to people not being able to obtain primary and preventive care, and even lead to reduced life expectancies. So the U.S. rations health care based on the ability to pay. People without health insurance have more trouble getting care, or they don't get it at all, with severe consequences for their health. But that is not the whole story of the American way of rationing. I show in my book that the U.S. has rationed health care in many other ways: by race, by region or location, by type of insurance coverage, by health condition, by age, by marital or parental status, by gender, and the list actually goes on. I'm going to give just a few examples from history of these various types of rationing, starting with race. You're probably all aware that a Jim Crow system existed in healthcare, as it did elsewhere in the South. But did you know that a separate and unequal hospital system was built and paid for with federal funding? The Hill-Burton Act of 1946, which allocated billions in federal dollars to expand the U.S. hospital system after World War II, included a special provision allowing Southern hospitals to separate black and white patients. There are cases on record of patients dying and women giving birth in the hospital parking lot because the segregated black section of the hospital was full, even if there was room in the white section. In the North, there was another kind of rationing by race. In Chicago and many other northern cities, ambulances would take African-American emergency patients to the public hospital, even if a private hospital was much closer, and people died because of this practice. Even after official discrimination was outlawed, other types of rationing by race continued. For example, the flight of hospitals from inner city neighborhoods to mostly white suburbs. The U.S. healthcare system also rations by employment or job status. After the defeat of the Truman National Health Plan in the 40s, instead of universal health care, we developed a system of private health insurance provided as a benefit of employment and supported by the federal tax code. And this is still how most Americans get their health care today, health coverage. So insurance coverage and access to health care depends on whether you are employed and where you are employed, whether your employer chooses or is able to provide health benefits, and what kind, and how much of the cost your employer is willing or able to cover. A system based on employer health coverage excludes a lot of people. People who work for smaller employers, the unemployed, women who temporarily leave the workforce to have children, the poor, and the retired don't have access to insurance provided by an employer. Rationing by employment means that people who retire lose health coverage at a time when they will probably start to need it the most. And it was this flaw in the employment-based health system that helped lead to the creation of Medicare in 1965. But Medicare itself is a system of rationing by age. There's no logical reason to give all people over 65 a completely different kind of health coverage than people under 65, except that is the way the health system evolved, creating incremental programs to try to cover the gaps. And we have another completely different system for the poor, Medicaid, which rations by one of the most ancient methods of all, the means test, a test to determine if you're poor enough to be eligible for the program. How old you are, how poor you are, where you work, and of course, how much money you have. The answers to these questions determine what kind of health coverage and care are available to you in the healthcare system, if any is available to you at all. So do we still think the U.S. doesn't ration? We have entirely separate healthcare systems for veterans and for Native Americans. We have public and private hospitals, doctors who accept Medicaid or who refuse Medicaid, doctors and hospitals that are in your network or out of your network, access to care that is based not on how sick you are, but on how much insurance you have, the right to care in an emergency room, but not in a doctor's office, people getting too much medical care and people unable to see a doctor at all. The American way of rationing is complicated, it's confusing, and it's very irrational. And when you add it all up, this kind of rationing leads to a system that is the most expensive in the world. In the U.S., we spend over $8,000 per person on health care each year, nearly twice as much as Canada and Germany, more than twice as much as Britain and Japan. Rationing is supposed to lead to lower costs, but the American way of rationing costs a fortune. And what do we get for all that money? 41 countries have a higher average life expectancy than the U.S. 40 countries have a lower infant mortality rate than we do. We have one of the poorest records of actually curing people of treatable diseases in the Western world. And all of our spending still leaves millions without health coverage. Does the Affordable Care Act continue, or does it disrupt the American way of rationing? I could say that it does a little bit of both, but at 2,500 pages, it actually does a lot of both. First of all, by requiring insurance companies to accept people with pre-existing conditions, Obamacare strikes a major blow against rationing by health condition. I don't think it's possible to overstate the significance of this, because it's basically telling insurance companies that they have to fundamentally change the way they do business, that their job is to cover sick people as well as healthy ones. Imagine that. And that is a very big change for the American insurance industry. Requiring everyone to buy health insurance or pay a fine, the individual mandate, is not exactly a right. It's more of an obligation. But offering federal subsidies to people who otherwise couldn't afford the insurance goes some way toward alleviating rationing of coverage by ability to pay. The law will also reduce rationing on the basis of gender, which I will talk more about in a little while. There are many important provisions in the Act that will help tilt the balance toward more preventive care and greater access to primary care. But there are also many ways that things will remain the same. The Affordable Care Act, as I said earlier, does not create universal coverage. And it builds upon and leaves fairly intact a multi-tiered, unequal health system of private insurance, public insurance, different insurance for the middle class and poor, for the employed and unemployed, the young and the old, etc. I don't mean to dismiss the achievement of this reform. It is historic. And it certainly brings us closer to universal coverage than anything we've had before. But it doesn't change the system's fundamental nature of separating people into many different categories in a way that is inefficient, very expensive, and in many ways unjust. Something else I write about in the book is the history of opposition to inequality and injustice in American healthcare. And there has been a long and honorable, if beleaguered, opposition. Women activists have had a major impact on advancing the right to healthcare and critiquing the American way of rationing in the past century. You may have heard that it was Theodore Roosevelt who started the health insurance movement early in the 20th century. You heard that? But actually it was women garment workers and labor organizers in the 1910s who first joined with progressive reformers to advocate for state-sponsored insurance for workers. Earlier, I talked about how Florence Greenberg, another labor organizer, demanded recognition of healthcare as a right during the Great Depression. And in the time remaining, I'd like to talk about two other women later in the 20th century who refused to accept the American way of rationing and took a stand on behalf of healthcare as a right. So we're going to jump ahead 3 decades after Florence Greenberg's speech, after the passage of Medicare and Medicaid, to September of 1970, when the American Hospital Association held its annual meeting in Houston, Texas. The American Hospital Association, or the AHA, you may have heard of them. They're kind of like the AMA for hospitals. They're not as well known as the AMA, but very powerful lobbying group on behalf of the interests of private hospitals in the U.S. for over a century. The 1970 meeting of the AHA turned out to be unlike any they'd ever had before, because the hospital delegates were greeted by a picket line of mostly African-American women and children who were carrying signs and chanting, saying things like, "equal treatment for Medicaid patients and hospital care for the poor." These picketers represented the National Welfare Rights Organization, a grassroots group made up of thousands of welfare recipients, or welfare mothers, as they were sometimes called, and they sometimes called themselves that as well. This meeting of the Hospital Association in 1970 was the first major action in the welfare rights movement's campaign to stop discrimination against the poor in the healthcare system. The welfare mothers demanded to speak to the convention, and eventually their request was granted.
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
A woman named Geraldine Smith, who was the National Welfare Rights Organization's financial secretary, got up in front of the convention and made an absolutely blistering speech. She told the audience of hospital lobbyists that the American Hospital Association is hypocritical, selfish, parochial, and patronizing, and that hospitals hide behind a screen of concern for the disadvantaged while perpetuating an unequal system of health care. Smith then presented the delegates with a list of demands from the welfare rights movement. She told hospital officials to end the practice of dumping poor and uninsured patients or transferring them in unstable condition. She demanded the establishment of clinics that people could attend instead of going to the emergency room. She called for a requirement for all hospitals to accept Medicaid patients. She demanded that patient representatives and members of the community, especially representatives of the poor, should have seats on hospital boards. She asked for informed consent about medical treatments, and especially that all patients should be treated with dignity and respect. So supposedly the audience of hospital officials listened very politely to all this, but when Smith had finished speaking, they went about their business at the convention as if nothing had happened. But shortly after this meeting, the American Hospital Association began drafting the first Patients' Bill of Rights, which was eventually adopted by hospitals all over the country and included crucial rights that Geraldine Smith had mentioned, such as the right for patients to have informed consent. Hospitals also began around this time to include community representatives on their governing boards. As you might imagine, the AHA's Bill of Rights didn't resemble what the Welfare Rights Bill of Rights would have looked like. It did not include any of the rights to access to health care that Geraldine Smith had demanded. And these bills certainly did not recognize a right to health care. But they did represent a turning point. The voices of patients could no longer be ignored. The welfare mothers' invasion of the hospital meeting in 1970 brought the language of patients' rights into the mainstream health system for the first time. And my second example fits really well with last night's keynote address, because she was an activist from Detroit. Her name was Olga Medar, and she started working in auto plants in the 1930s and became the first female member of the executive board of the United Auto Workers. In the 70s, Madar was one of the co-founders of the Coalition of Labor Union Women, or CLU, and she became its president in 1974. As president of CLU, Madar led the first national campaign against discrimination against women by the private health insurance industry. In a speech that was reported in newspapers around the country, Madar announced that insurance companies were charging women premiums as much as 150% higher than men's. Insurers justified this practice by arguing that women had higher health costs. "They describe us as clunkers," said Madar. "Like old cars, we break down. We're unreliable. We're out to defraud and bankrupt the insurance industry." Madar pointed out that as well as charging women higher premiums, insurance companies refused to cover pregnancy and childbirth or offered only minimal coverage at very high expense. Because of the concept of moral hazard, pregnancy and childbirth were considered to be uninsurable conditions because women supposedly planned them in advance. And you're not supposed to buy health insurance knowing that you're going to use it. That's really what they said. Some companies covered maternity. Some companies did cover maternity, but only for the wives of male employees, while female workers were denied coverage. And comprehensive coverage of maternity services in the 1970s, as late as the 1970s, was virtually non-existent. Madar's activism against gender bias in health insurance helped lead to the passage of the Pregnancy Discrimination Act of 1978, which required large employers to include maternity coverage in their health plans. But like all health reforms in the U.S., these new rights only helped some of the population. The small group and individual health insurance markets, which were the only options for people not working for large employers, continued to blatantly discriminate against women. Until 2012, until this year, a majority of individual health insurance plans charge women more than men, a practice called gender rating. And most of these plans even charged women non-smokers more than male smokers. And the majority of individual insurance plans through this year still excluded maternity coverage. But this year, important provisions of the Affordable Care Act took effect that will ban many types of gender discrimination in the insurance market. The law doesn't stop such discrimination entirely. Abortion services are placed in a special category, and states can ban abortion coverage altogether. But the law still contains many provisions that seek to end rationing by gender. All new health care plans will be required to charge men and women equally and to include coverage for maternity care. In addition, since August the 1st of this year, Obamacare requires all health plans to cover without co-payments many preventive and screening services for women, including mammograms, pap smears, prenatal care, lactation support, domestic violence screening, and contraception. I think that these coverage expansions, alongside the definitive end of gender rating and the ban on excluding pre-existing conditions, are the most truly historic aspects of the new law, and they will make the greatest inroads against the American way of rationing. But we also have to ask why it took so long to get here and why it was so difficult. Blatant gender discrimination survived until 2012, 100 years after progressive women reformers called for equal treatment of maternity in health insurance. And as you all know, we face an election in which one party vows to repeal even those modest gains for equality in health coverage. The fight for health security in the United States is far from over. While all other affluent nations agreed long ago that basic health care should be a right of all citizens, the U.S. continues to treat medical care as a product to be purchased in the marketplace. Even now, the most sweeping reform in our history embodies this tension between the rights of the people and the rights of private companies and individuals to profit from the healthcare system. The three women I described in this talk lived at different times or in different parts of the country. They didn't know each other and never even heard of each other. But what all three of them had in common was their belief that ordinary citizens could take the lead in presenting a new vision of what our healthcare system could be. I think that all three of them would hope that the Affordable Care Act, despite its flaws, will lead to a continuing and open and participatory national debate about how the American healthcare system can best serve the needs of all the people. And thank you for listening.
We have time for questions, and the way that we'd like to do this is that Beatrix will stay up there, and I will come around to the microphone and hold it for anyone who has a question. So if people just start putting up your hands as you have questions, and I will come and find you.
Is that definitive, huh?
Sure. thank you very much for a wonderful talk, and I've purchased your book, and I look forward to reading it. My name is Anne Hiskus, and I'm a recent dean of Brooks College of Interdisciplinary Studies, of which Women and Gender Studies is in my program, so I'm my college, so I'm very happy to be here. I'm very interested in the idea of human rights, and have read the book about Eleanor Roosevelt's role in the writing of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And I'm wondering to what extent philosophical debates have played a role in the politics of the United States. I would expect probably not very much. But United States is born out of the philosophy, political philosophy of our country is born out of the Enlightenment values of, endowed by our Creator with basic rights of a pursuit of happiness, liberty, and freedom. And this was always at odds with the economic and cultural rights. And so I'm wondering to what extent any debates have occurred in our history about what is a human right versus maybe other kinds of civil rights or economic rights. And is the problem that the right to health care is not seen as a human right, transcending what governments may or may not do?
Thank you for defining a human right as opposed to other types of rights. Human rights are intended to transcend citizenship, national borders, etc. And it is true that the United States does again take a different approach, especially to economic, social, and social rights as human rights. And I'm glad you read that book about Eleanor Roosevelt and the UN Declaration. But even Eleanor Roosevelt, I was actually surprised at how strongly she advocated for the inclusion of social rights in the UN Declaration, because I had expected the U.S. stance to be much more focused on individual rights, what we would also consider negative rights, freedom from oppression, freedom from control by the state, et cetera. But both Roosevelts, FDR and ER, were absolutely crucial in including these social rights in the UN Declaration. But that didn't resonate here. It didn't resonate, and there were also organized groups that worked to oppose the acceptance of such rights, such as the medical profession, certain business groups, etc. There was actually a specific campaign to prevent the U.S. from accepting the economic and social, the Covenant on Economic and Social Rights in the 90s. That was run by the Eagle Forum, a conservative group. So I think there was a lot of ideological resistance to social rights, but there's also been an organized political resistance to them, and that those have combined to make a less than fertile ground for social rights as human rights in the U.S.
One morning I woke up and I knew a new day, a new way, and new eyes to look. Go the way of the mind and God. The sky is clearing and the night is bright. The sun. Come, the world's all for love.
made you roar.
More from Great Speeches and Interviews after these messages.